New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, Mind, Body, Spirit University, a leader in fully accredited in-person and online U.S. college degree programs in the topics we cover here. Visit their website at cihs.edu.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlov.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlov. Today we'll be exploring poetry and the occult, with a special emphasis on the work of Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes. My guest is Julia Gordon Bramer, a master of fine arts, a professional tarot reader, a poet, a former professor in the graduate writing program at Lindenwood University near St. Louis, Missouri. She is author of Fixed Stars Govern a Life, Decoding Sylvia Plath. Decoding Sylvia Plath's Daddy, Discover the Layers of Meaning Behind the Brute. Decoding Sylvia Plath's Lady Lazarus, Freedom's Feminine Fire. Tarot Life Lessons, Living Wisdom from the Major Arcana, and most recently, The Occult Sylvia Plath, The Hidden Spiritual Life of the Visionary Poet. Julia lives in St. Louis, and now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Julia. It is a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Jeffrey.
You are a unique individual in the sense that you're combining literary scholarship with your practice as a professional tarot reader. It probably makes you very unique in the world of tarot and in the world of literary scholarship.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've always been kind of a misfit wherever I go, and especially in academia. But yeah, in the tarot world, always know what to make of me, and they don't always know what I'm talking about, because not everybody reads literature anymore either.
Well, and your main focus is Sylvia Plath, and I have to confess, probably like most of the viewers on the New Thinking Aloud channel, they've heard the name. Everybody seems to have heard that name somewhere along the lines. I asked my wife, and she said, well, didn't she commit suicide, or die by suicide is really the current way of describing it. I asked another one of my co-partners here on the New Thinking Aloud channel, and she said, I've heard the name, but I don't know anything else about Sylvia Plath. But I think the amazing thing is that we're talking about a young poet, a brilliant young poet, who died at the age of 30. And here now, more than 60 years after her death, is still remembered and studied.
Yeah, I mean, she's still hot. You know, she's very trendy. She's a cultural icon. Gwyneth Paltrow has starred as her in a movie in the early 2000s. And there are songs written, for her and about her by rock stars like Lana Del Rey and Ryan Adams and Lady Gaga. She's hot. I have reasons, my reasons for believing why, which I can share. But Sylvia Plath has not gone out of style, even if people only know a couple of the rudimentary basics about her. She died by suicide. She's kind of known for the poet who put her head in the oven, by gas, not baking. Some people get confused about that, and people who know a little bit more about her may know that she wrote the book The Bell Jar, which continues to be a best-selling novel, a very autobiographical novel. And if they know a little more about her, they know that she and her husband Ted Hughes were were two very gorgeous people, and that he was quite the philanderer and maybe didn't treat her so well.
Since we're going to be focusing on the occult, Ted Hughes becomes a very important character because I gather most of the readers and critics of Sylvia Plath don't consider her as a poet of the mystical or the occult. That's not the case with him. He was very open, I gather, about his interest in mysticism.
Yeah, I mean, not so much open at that time, but he's been, as he got older, he's been widely studied, and people have written about his Kabbalah and his alchemy and his astrology and his spells, and, you know, all of this stuff is across all sorts of memoirs and analyses of his work. And Plath worshipped Hughes. And yet it's really odd to me that nobody thought to look at her work, you know, in that same light. He was her mentor. He gave her exercises, you know, academics know this, and yet they never thought to consider her as a mystic, which is really, I think, a sexist statement when you get down to it.
From what little I know about poetry, I like poetry, but I'm hardly a scholar or even an aficionado of poetry. But I had not heard of him. She seemed to be a more popular poet than he, although I learned from your writing that he was the poet laureate of England.
Yeah. You haven't heard about him because you're American. Over in Britain, he's the rock star. I mean, they love her too. But Plath, you know, Plath may have more global appeal overall, but Ted Hughes got famous first, and he's certainly widely known in the UK and respected and revered. Yeah.
When it comes to poets, great poets who were into mysticism, into the occult, one has to also consider W.B. Yeats, who I imagine overlapped with them in terms of, I'm not sure exactly when he died.
They worshipped him. They worshipped Yeats. And in fact, Sylvia wrote that she wanted to be like William and Georgie Yeats, you know, as the couple, her and Ted, and to work together, because Georgie, William Butler Yeats's wife, was she channeled stuff, and she did automatic writing for him. And together they were a mystic force. And of course, Yeats got all the credit. But she, you know, Plath wanted to be that kind of mystical team. And she has journaled about it, and she was given studies of Yeats's mysticism that she read very carefully from her mother, by the way. And you know, there's a book called The Unicorn that was very important to her, that her mother Aurelia gave to her and Ted one Christmas. And so, you know, this is going, Yeats, of course, was connected with the Hermetic Order Golden Dawn, which established one of the first modern tarot decks, the Rider-Waite deck. They were friends with T.S. Eliot, who also had Hermetic connections and was a mystic in his own right. So, you know, poetry has always carried mysticism along with it. It's one of the first spells, you know, this sort of rhythmic mantra, you know, stories that can be remembered with, you know, story songs, you might say. And there's a reason they say spelling, you know, to have spelling. When we spell letters, we're getting words just right. And so poetry is part of that mystical power of language. You know, in the Bible, they say, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And this is just a powerful force. And Plath and Hughes knew how to work it, and they learned from the greats, really originating probably with Shakespeare, who they worshipped.
It strikes me that poetry and mysticism have always been deeply connected. I mean, think of Homer, for example, and the Aeneids. The earliest poets were always trying to interpret the divine.
Yes, yes, exactly. And they did a pretty good job of it because we're still reading Homer.
Now let's bring in your interest in the tarot, because the tarot was very important to the Order of the Golden Dawn. It was very important to Ted Hughes. And you point out that Sylvia Plath also integrated the tarot deck into her poetry, even though I gather the army of critics who write about Sylvia Plath today don't seem to realize this.
Right, right. So when I was in graduate school, getting my MFA in creative writing for poetry and fiction, and I've always loved Plath since I was 16 years old, which coincidentally, if you believe in such things, was the first year that I got my first tarot deck. And I was, I noticed that there was a lot of tarot imagery in Plath's work. And I brought it to the attention of my professor. And I said, Dr. Schreiner, what's the deal? You know, here's the King of Swords and here's the Empress and here's the person, you know, and I was showing him these various images and he's looked at me and he goes, I don't know what you're talking about. And it was then that I realized you had to be both a tarot scholar and a Plath scholar to see this, and that I was in a very unique position. And so he suggested I made it my semester end project, and it became my life's work. So it was very soon afterward that I learned that in Ariel, which is kind of Plath's, this was published posthumously. It came out in a different version initially. Ted Hughes had rearranged, but in the early 2000s, their daughter Frieda Hughes decided this needed to be published as Sylvia wanted it published. So this is Ariel, the restored edition. And I have to say, I might not have found this work had this restored edition not been out, because then I saw very clearly that she had aligned each of her Ariel poems with the tarot card. And in many cases, each poem describes the card. It talks about the colors. It talks about whatever you're seeing in the picture. The meanings of the cards are always in that. And she's embedded all of this stuff in it that completely changes the meaning of the poem. Reading Plath just for her autobiography. And so people think that she's just, you know, angry and depressive and that's, you know, suicidal. That's the limit. They've put her in this box and they really don't see that she was a genius's genius. And what my first book, which I'll show you, it's out of print now, but Fixed Stars Govern a Life, Decoding Sylvia Plath. I published this with Stephen F. Austin State University Press in 2014. And that book shows that each poem has a minimum of six different meanings in alignment with Kabbalah and alchemy and mythology and astrology and the arts and humanities, you know, and I'm forgetting something here. Oh, and history and the world. And she has all of these aspects built in to each poem. And so the same set of words can be read six different ways, minimum. And I mean, I don't know if you've tried to write poetry, if you've tried to insert even just double meanings, but what she's done is astounding. And I would have thought that the Plath community would have embraced that and been very excited. But what I got was a real pushback. You know, as I came in here, I was like, oh my gosh, look what I found, you know, and, you know, this poem means this and this. And instead I got crickets, because what I realized is, first of all, they don't want to look at it. Academia is largely atheistic. Plath called herself an atheist, by the way, but everybody knows who studied her. She was the most mystical, spiritual atheist ever. You know, she used Ouija boards and bibliomancy and tarot and all kinds of spells and, you know, and deeply into all of that stuff. And so the other thing is that, you know, their whole careers are built upon her being the miserable depressive. And so they don't want to rock that boat.
Well, this is a paradox because on the one hand, you have great poets going back to the age of Homer who are deeply involved with the divine, with the supersensible realms of reality. And on the other hand, you've got the modern era, which is largely materialistic, and particularly the scholarly community. As a parapsychologist myself, I know very well about the antagonism of mainstream academia towards anything having to do with phenomena that cannot be explained by a materialistic metaphysics. But it does seem paradoxical in the world of poetry because poets have almost universally taken an interest in metaphysics.
Yeah. Here's the thing. What I've written in my new book, The Occult Sylvia Plath, is absolutely hard evidence. So, I mean, I've been sitting in the Plath archives for 15 years going over the book she read and talking about what she underlined and starred and little marginalia in her books. I talk about notes on calendars, just proving, yes, she knew about this. She knew about that. She was fascinated by such and such. She wrote a school paper about this subject. You know, the things that haven't been published about her and a lot of the things that have. I also got into letters, not just letters from Sylvia Plath, which are published, but the letters that were to her where boyfriend Richard Sassoon talked about, you know, such and such with spells or whatever. Boyfriend Myron Lotz, you know, who worshipped her. Gordon Lamire. Yeah, you know, there were lots of communications to her that are in the archives that people don't know about. And so in The Occult Sylvia Plath, there's nothing I made up. Everything is backed by hard evidence, including I set the scene. You know, I start each of the four parts with a scene with Plath and Hughes around the Ouija board. And that all comes from, number one, her poem, Dialogue Over a Word. But also it comes from just the details that she wrote to her mother about how the room was set up and certain smells that were in the room that she might have addressed, you know, in a journal entry or in a poem or, you know, so I did not make up anything in this book. And everything is footnoted and indexed. And so this isn't the typical paranormal supposition, I guess we could say. This is factual. I am approaching it as a scholar, granted a paranormal scholar.
Well, you probably know that hardcore scientific interest in the occult and the paranormal and mysticism has been going on for 150 years. In fact, I know in your book you refer to this Society for Psychical Research in England, which goes back to 1882. And today, if you talk to mainstream psychologists, for the most part, they will say things like, oh, there isn't a shred of evidence.
There is. I mean, it's in the archives. My evidence is that Plath believed in stuff and used this stuff. You know, do I have evidence that it's all true? No, I can't go that far. What I can say is that she and Ted Hughes, using these systems, produced a body of work like no other in a very short life, and that it cast a spell on the world, and it's still affecting people today. And, you know, if you want to say that that's evidence, I would. But is it empirical? Maybe not. You know, maybe I can't test it. Maybe I don't have this quality control group of people who are using the system and not. Because, of course, talent is a very unique thing, and her IQ and her upbringing and all of that make her the individual that she was. But so it isn't something that's easily testable. But as far as proving she was into it, that's easy. And I have the hard evidence there.
I think there are two different ways of approaching the what we might call the supernatural or the paranormal. One is scientific, through testing, through science, and that's what parapsychologists generally do. But there's also, one might say, an approach through the humanities, which is to understand what does it mean? And that's really the role of the poet.
Yeah. And really to the reader too, because poems are a uniquely personal experience. And, you know, we all have maybe a favorite poem, but I'm sure it's a different poem, because what speaks to me, you know, is something that, that touches me because of my background and just, you know, what moves me. And it may be very different to what moves you, Jeffrey, but it is, it's kind of a personal magic. And people are always finding new meanings for poems that the poets didn't even intend as well. And I'm sure there's a lot of that with Plath's work, honestly. But, you know, Plath has been kind of relegated to be the poet of the angsty girls and the emo cutters and the, you know, the depressive. And that's a damn shame. You know, I'm happy that they resonate with her and that they get something out of it too. But that's just that thin biographical superficial level, and they don't know of, you know, that she was actually talking, you know, about the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis and all of this mythology and all this alchemy, and, you know, and it's all in there and in such rich detail, and each poem is just loaded with resonance, and it's doing enough in our subconscious that we don't even fully understand. And that I'm trying to explain. And that's the spell.
You, in another interview, referred to Ted Hughes, her husband, as a magician. In fact, I think you even called him a master magician.
Yeah. In fact, the working title of the occult Sylvia Plath was The Magician's Girl. And that's because she has a line in her poem, The Bee Meeting, that she says, "I am the magician's girl. I do not flinch." And he mentored her. And you know, and I think, like The Magician's Apprentice, that famous story, Goethe wrote it in the first version. We all know it with Walt Disney and Mickey Mouse and that broom that goes a little wild and the buckets and the, or maybe I'm dating myself. I don't know that your younger fans will know this, but in any case, it's about the magician's apprentice becoming stronger and better than the master, which I think she did.
And yet he became the poet laureate of England many years after she died.
And Plath predicted that. She said that she saw him becoming Britain's poet laureate and that she wanted to be the poetess of America. Yeah, and certainly was, if not the world.
Well, I'm interested in your book from an angle that I'm not even sure you have quite considered, which is the idea of survival after death. That's one of the areas of great interest to me. And I know in another interview you gave, you talk about a crucial moment when you're studying her work and you're at a point where you need to decide whether you want to continue or not, and you heard her speak to you.
Yeah, so that's actually in the introduction of my first book, which anyone can read the introduction on my acnea.edu site. I posted the whole beginning of Fixed Stars, Govern a Life. So what I talk about there is I was coming through, you know, I've been working poem by poem, matching them with the tarot cards. And so as each tarot card embodies, you know, numerology and astrology and mythology, I was looking for that corresponding stuff in each poem, as Plath had set up Ariel. And so I was in the 15th poem, which is the title poem, Ariel, and it matches to card number 14, because of course we start with zero, with the Fool. And so I'm reading the poem Ariel, and what I found was that a great deal of this poem was sort of a paraphrasing of an Aleister Crowley prayer to the great beast 666. And at that moment, I froze. And I was like, I don't know if I'm even comfortable with this because, you know, Crowley, I think, he was a bit of an oddball. But I'm no Satanist. And I tend to think of myself as love and light and being positive. And I had this Christian upbringing and, you know, in the Episcopal, actually. And so I was very uncomfortable thinking that my heroes, Plath and Hughes, might have been satanic. And I thought, I don't know if I even want to continue. You know, like, how ugly, how dark is this going to get? And so I went to bed that night. And just as I was drifting off, I heard audibly. Now, this is interesting because I am clairaudient, meaning that as I'm doing tarot card readings, I'll hear inner voices. But I heard this in my ear, and it said, and it was in Plath's voice, which I know very well because I've listened to multitudes of her recordings. She said, "Move through." And she commanded me. It was like yelling in my ear. And I woke up with a full start, and I knew I was never going to forget the sound of her voice, which I have not yet. And I was like, okay. I said, I'll do the next poem and I'll see what that's about. Well, that's all it took, because the next poem after the Temperance card is in alignment with the Devil card. She was setting up the Devil card. And, you know, and that's the thing about Ariel is it's very seamless. I published a paper on that she carries words from one poem to the next. And so it's this journey. We can read an individual poem and it stands on its own just fine, but it is a journey to read Ariel and it is a process. And so just in the same way that she'll take an interesting word here and you'll find it in the very next poem, she was doing the same thing with some images and she was introducing us to the devil by weaving in this Crowley prayer. And so, made perfect sense then. And then I could relax a little bit. And then, sure enough, the next poem is in alignment with the Tower card and all of that imagery. And so she was just setting the scene. But I got scared. I got a little traditional there. And so she's taught me an awful lot, not only about poetry, but about tarot and mysticism.
Well, the very name Ariel, of course, is reminiscent of Shakespeare and the magical spirit who appears in The Tempest.
That's right. That's right. And she was working all the meanings on that. She was also working the homophone of Ariel, like being in the sky, because that poem specifically addresses in the historical aspect the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so when it begins and we've got, I'm terrible at recalling lines of poetry when I'm on a camera, but, you know, it begins with basically the pilot flying over Japan and looking at the poor of Tor and distances, Tor being mountainous regions, and dropping the atomic bomb. And then it gets into people turning into shadows and their skin peeling off and fleeing. And I mean, it's quite graphic in its description of the atomic bomb. So she was working it on all levels. And I learned to pay attention to the homophones as well as, you know, yeah, the Ariel character of Shakespeare is also in there. And also the alchemical element of air and so much more. So she was brilliant. You know, like I said, a genius is genius.
Well, the fact that you heard her voice so clearly and in her actual voice and not just in your head, but through your ears, suggests to me, in the light of everything else you've written about her, that her spirit really did live on, and it affected her husband, it affected the woman, Asha, whom he had an affair with, whom he left her for. It affected him for decades. And other people who knew her, it's as if her death didn't prevent her spirit from having an enormous impact. I suspect probably even more after she died than when she was alive.
Yeah, I mean, truly, he had talked about being haunted by her, and some of the other girlfriends also used that word. And I don't think it was so much that she was an apparition, was showing up in front of them, as much as just they couldn't escape. You know, they couldn't escape the thought of her. Everything meant something with Sylvia. Her things were around them all the time. But, you know, Asha Wevel was quite obsessed with Sylvia and wore her clothes and used her hairbrush and ties and, you know, and barrettes and things, which is a little weird if you think about it. You know, the other woman using all the dead wife's things. It's almost as if Asha was kind of possessed by Sylvia as well. And, you know, however you want to take that, I'm not sure Sylvia would have wanted that. But, she had a presence that lived on, to be sure. And then going back to my experience, I mean, I've had a number of occasions I felt certainly connected with her, certainly like she brought me to the answer. And it wasn't, again, it was not an apparition in front of me, how I would love that. I wrote a poem about that, actually, called Seeing Sylvia Plath, which is up on also on academia.edu. And I can never remember where I first published them, so I throw it all there later. But I think the biggest thing for me was in 2021, I was contacted by Dr. Richard Larshan, who was a friend of the Plath family's, and he had inherited a lot of objects and, you know, kind of books and materials from Aurelia Plath. He was like another son to Sylvia Plath's mother. And so she had given him a lot of things. And one of the objects that she had given him was a hermetic caduceus, which is essentially like a magic wand. And Plath had carved it out of wood in her teens. At summer camp, and she has at the handle, it's got a big SP on the handle. And you know, Dr. Larshan is an old man. He's in his 80s, and he wanted to make sure that it went in the right hands of someone who appreciated it truly. And so it's mine. And I keep it in a safe, but it's priceless. It's probably worth more than my house. And just to give you an idea, Sylvia Plath's tarot cards were auctioned off in 2020, and these cards that she did not make, you know, that were just printed, and really there's some questionable evidence to how often she even used this particular deck. It was a Tarot de Marseille, and my evidence shows that she used the Rider-Waite deck, which, you know, I could go into detail about. But what we've got is something so precious here. I started to say that tarot deck auctioned off for over $200,000, U.S. dollars. And she didn't make that. She made this, and her initials are on it. And so I just think of all the things that, you know, I didn't even try to own this. And it came to me, you know, and what a blessing and beyond my wildest dream. So I don't know. To me, that's just such concrete evidence. And then I guess the other thing is, and there are other smaller things. When I was in the archives, and I remember working on her childhood journals, which nobody's really given that much attention to. They've kind of scrolled through them. And you know, she was a kid, and they're not terribly interesting. She talked about all her meals at summer camp, and she talked about some of her radio shows. But she did also talk about her friends and relationships and what movies she saw and what books she was reading. And this was all valuable to me to show her building knowledge, for one. Also, she talked about playing Tarot, which is a game you can play with tarot, and her Sunday school homework in the Unitarian Church, studying astrology and things like that. But I was in the midst of, you know, I guess it was her 1945 journal, and I had already seen the entry I kind of went fast forward into disseminate her entry about the bombing of Pearl Harbor and the things the scholars have noticed. But I wondered if I should even waste my time going through that day-to-day, more mundane stuff. And I was in my hotel room kind of wondering this aloud, just talking to myself. And I said, should I even finish this? And then on my television, a commercial comes on. And the first thing I hear in this commercial is 1945. And it's a World War II movie. It's a trailer. And I look at that and I was like, all right, I got to finish the 1945 journal. There it is. And I found a lot of really fascinating stuff that day, even slogging through the more boring details. I've had just so many little moments of feeling guided, and I can't dispute that. And then ultimately, when I was having so much trouble with academia, and I had fought and fought to kind of earn their respect and get, some acknowledgement and attention for what I was doing. And I was just being iced out at conferences and poo-pooed here and there, and even mocked and humiliated. And I finally said, they're not my people. And I kind of just sat on it for a couple of years and I didn't do anything. And then I guess I realigned my energies is the way I would explain it. And I got this fan letter on Instagram from a wonderful woman, Tamara Lucid, and she said that she'd come across my first three PLAS books, and she loved what I was doing, and could I tell her more about my work? And I said, well, I'm sitting on this book here, The Occult Sylvia PLAS, and I also told her I'm a professional tarot card reader, and I put together a book called Tarot Life Lessons Through COVID, which was just my journal entries about some of my more meaningful tarot card readings that, the ones I didn't want to forget. And perhaps a little bit in that one too, because how could she not be? She's so infused in my life in every way. So I told Tamara about these things and she said, I want to hook you up with a friend of mine, John Graham over at Inner Traditions. He's an editor. And she connected us. And John Graham was interested first in Tarot Life Lessons. And he read it and he gave me a contract like on the spot. And then he said, let me see this plaque stuff. And I sent that over. And the next thing I had a contract for that too. So blessed. And again, it's like, I didn't even try. And that's how spirit works. That's when you know your path. And I do believe PLAS has been guiding me all along, really right from the time I was 16 years old and I got my first tarot deck, because that was when I first started to read PLAS at the same time. I always found I have some very strange coincidences with her. My grandmother's name is Sylvia. My grandfather, well, my mother's British. She moved to America and married an American man very quickly. Plath was American, moved to Britain and married a British man very quickly. My grandfather lost, well, first of all, he died when I was 8. Plath lost her father when she was 8. Her father lost his left leg. My grandfather lost his left leg. There are all these really peculiar little coincidences. And what I call, I don't know if you're familiar with the Lincoln Kennedy coincidence, where they line up the president. And I've done that with me in PLAS. So I think I'm her. And I always want to say that. Like, I do not believe that I'm her resurrected. I will say I was born almost exactly 9 months after she died, though, in 1963. But what I do believe is that I'm here for her. And I was maybe born for her, for this work. And I think of myself, I joke that I'm kind of John the Baptist, prepare ye the way. And I'm trying to wake everybody up and I'm trying to let them see what this magnificent woman did, and just how she's so much more than her drama. So that's my goal.
I will have to, at some point, send you my paper on archetypal synchronistic resonance.
Oh, I'd like to see that.
Well, you brought up the synchronicity earlier, and I know that Carl Jung's theories are very important in understanding the tarot. And in fact, in looking at subjects like alchemy and Kabbalah, Carl Jung is the one psychologist who was able to integrate those things into his psychological thinking.
And Plath and Hughes read Jung. Plath read a lot of Freud. Of course, Carl Jung was Freud's student for a time. But she knew, she was very familiar with Jung and his theories and Ted Hughes. Oh gosh, I think he read everything by Carl Jung. So they were not ignorant to that at all.
It's a massive body of work that Jung created. And of course, when you combine that with Hermeticism and alchemy and tarot, this realm of the occult, even though it's hidden for the most part from mainstream culture, which is what the word occult actually means, is hidden, it's vast. It's absolutely enormous. And from my point of view, it touches every aspect of our culture.
Yeah, absolutely it does, whether you believe in it or not. And, you know, Jung was so great about just showing these patterns and synchronicities. And and it's all through Plath's work.
Since you brought up Tamra Lucid, it's probably worth mentioning for the New Thinking Aloud viewers, many of whom are familiar with her husband, who goes by the pen name of Ronnie Pontiac, who has been a guest on this show many times and will continue to be a guest many more times. Tamra is apparently shy about being interviewed, but we've done an interview on the book they wrote together on the Orphic Hymns, which is yet another example of poetry and mysticism combining.
I'm soon going to meet Pontiac because I'm going to be a guest speaker and one of their projects. They're doing a class on mysticism and the occult and poets and all of that.
So it's very exciting in a way that you've come upon this, and I really feel sorry that you've had to suffer humiliation of all things from the academic circles. I can only say I've been through it myself, so I know what that's about.
This is not easy work. If I wanted a job that I would always be respected, you know, I mean, if I did not rock the boat, I'd probably be doing something administrative somewhere and I would always be nice and agreeable and, you know, but I just ran into a friend of mine's mother and I was always at their house growing up. And I said to her, I said, Mrs. O'Neill, did you ever expect that I would grow up to be a professional tarot card reader? And she said, what else could you have been? And, you know, and I was always the oddball, and I'm not comfortable in the norm, you know. So if I had wanted to have a real quiet, sedate life, I wouldn't have done this work, right? I like to keep it interesting.
Well, norms are changing. The fact that somebody was willing to pay $200,000 for Sylvia Plath's tarot deck suggests that other people are aware of the work you've done.
I really want to get my Hermetic Caduceus valued. I'd like to insure it. But what I'm finding is that nobody will really do that unless I want to put it up for auction. And there's not a chance. There's a show that I was talking to, a cable show, Masters, and I think that's what it's called, or Pawn Stars, something like that. and they actually interviewed me about it, and they're like, we would love to have this on, we would love to have you on the show, but you have to be willing to let it go. And I couldn't sign a document to say that. I said, this is priceless to me. Like, you know, we would have to be talking over $1 million. And even then it would hurt, you know, and I'm thinking, part of me's thinking, wow, I could really set up a sweet retirement with that. But Sylvia gave this to me, you know, And I have to at least keep it until I'm an old woman. And I suspect when I'm Richard Larson's age, if I haven't found a mentor or someone to pass it down to, not a mentor, but, you know, a protege, then I'll probably leave it to an archive or something like that, because it needs to be appreciated for sure. I take it out of my safe regularly and look at it and hold it and love it.
The caduceus is a hermetic symbol. It's also the symbol of the medical profession.
Yes. And it's got the entwined snakes on it and all of that. Yeah, she did it all. Mm-hmm. Every now and then I'll recharge it in a full moon.
I believe it's also a symbol associated with the rising of Kundalini energy.
Right. The snake going up the chakras. That's right.
So it's a very potent symbol, and it goes back to her teenage years.
Her mother, Aurelia Plath, got her master's degree on the subject of Paracelsus, the famous alchemist, the first alchemist. And Aurelia has said that Sylvia read all of her school books. Like they shared everything. Nothing scared Sylvia. I mean, she was so incredibly bright in school. She was reading beyond so many people. And so she had a real understanding of all of this stuff from a very young age. But getting into Kundalini quickly, Ted Hughes studied Kundalini and wrote on it somewhat and taught her some yogic breathing and meditation and that sort of thing too.
One thing I think is worth pointing out is if we take, for example, Buddhism as an important path toward mysticism, the purpose of Buddhism, been laid out very clearly, is to alleviate suffering. And I get the impression, although Ted Hughes, for example, was a master magician, he suffered greatly throughout his life, and he inflicted suffering on many other people as well, including Sylvia.
Yeah. An interesting thing is that they were both studying Kabbalah. I have a lot of evidence on that. And Kabbalah has a rule. And going back to the ancient, you know, rabbis, it's ancient Jewish mysticism. And these old rabbis said that, first of all, you must be a man. And secondly, you must be over 40 years old. So Sylvia, of course, broke both of those rules, and Ted broke one of them. And they probably thought that they were so much wiser than the average under 40, and they probably were, but they still just didn't have whatever it was, you know? And anyway, the punishment for breaking that rule of studying Kabbalah outside those lines is madness. And that's really interesting, given Plath's fragile state of mental health, ultimately, you know, ending in suicide. And while Hughes did not die by suicide, he had a lot of torment, and he had lovers who, you know, beyond Plath, and Asha Wevel being the main one who took his daughter with her. That was especially terrible. It's just interesting because Hughes suffered a great deal. There's a writer, A. Alvarez. He was a friend of both of them. He was an editor for the London Times. And he has an article out there. You can find it online. And it's called, Did Black Magic Kill Sylvia Plath? And he felt that she took herself down with some of this dark energy. Now, I wouldn't say that she was a black magician. I would not say that. But in those end times of hers, she did kind of roll off her rocker, you know, and she was chanting and putting his fingernail clippings and dandruff into fires and burning his manuscripts and saying some strange things that people have recorded in memoirs. And so, yeah, it seems that some of those darker energies certainly took them both.
Magic is ultimately a pursuit of power, an attempt to have real influence in the outer world. And frankly, I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting to have influence in the outer world. But when it comes at the cost of other people, then it does become dark.
Yeah. I am a student and practitioner and teacher of A Course in Miracles. And just to get another perspective, A Course in Miracles, it's very Buddhist, really. And so as the Buddhists believe that this whole world experience is illusion, and this is kind of our big sandbox, and we're all playing together in the illusion and evolving and figuring out who we are and learning our lessons, but none of it is real and authentic. And in A Course in Miracles, you know, they use the word miracle instead of magic because the idea, it's a higher energy and it's about healing and love and just focusing on that versus magic, which is about manipulating the illusion. So Plath and Hughes were very good at magic. You know, they picked out their astrologically auspicious dates to mail out their manuscripts for the best chance of the best publications. And they had everything in their Kabbalistic alignment They got very good at that. But it isn't necessarily the highest energy. I'll say it that way.
Well, Julia Gordon Bramer, what a pleasure to talk to you. I consider you a real pioneer, and I think of you as a forerunner. I expect that the day will come when people in the literary criticism community are going to have a greater awareness of the importance of such things as the Hermetic tradition on literature. It's a topic that has been overlooked for far too long, and you are a pioneer in this area, so I commend you.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Thanks. And I love what you do, too. So, it's so important to get the word out in all the different ways. So thank you.
And thank you for being with me and sharing your insights with the New Thinking Aloud audience. It's been a pleasure to meet you and to learn more about your scholarship.
Thanks so much.
And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us because you are the reason that we are here.
Three in the New Thinking Aloud dialogue series is UFOs and UAP, Are We Really Alone? Now available on Amazon.
You can now download a PDF copy or order a beautiful printed copy of issue 6 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.